I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 18th, 2011. Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, social media have changed the way we do pretty much everything, including spending money.
I think this is sort of a fun attempt at just being like, hey, you know what? Go out and spend a little bit. You know, don't be crazy about it. It's 20 bucks.
We'll hear about the birth of cash mobs in Cleveland. And forget the daily deals and sales. There is another way to get a bargain on that thing you want.
I've been very fortunate with refurbs, but I think they're less likely to give you problems than buying that new stuff.
Turning old into gold. Plus, if only you could go online and get help finding a parking space before you arrive. Yeah, I'd pay for that service.
I would sit there and I'd be like, all right, parking space, I know you're out there. Let's do it. We can do this. Let's go.
We've got the karma, parking, and otherwise on this week's edition of Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
If we've learned anything from the rising tide of anger over various aspects of the economy, it is that consumers still have one element on their side: choice. No one is telling you where to park your money or spend your money, and you can have an influence just by taking your dollars elsewhere. Well, this week, a group of citizens in Cleveland banded together to make their own point. They took the concept of the flash mob, those coordinated sing-alongs in mall food courts, and turned it into a buy local effort that they called a cash mob. Wednesday night, they targeted a locally owned store and mobbed it with $20 purchases. Brian Bull covered the story for station WCPN in Cleveland. Welcome.
Thank you, Tess.
So, cash mobs, please explain.
Well, like you said, Tess, there's no music or dancing, and there's certainly no rumble going down. People use social media like Twitter or Facebook to gather at a mutual meeting place, and then they target a local business with $20 in hand.
Now, I understand that you accompanied a cash mob this week in Cleveland. Tell us about it.
Roughly 36 people showed up in a part of Cleveland called Tremont, and here's one of the organizers, Andrew Samtoy.
Basically, to me, all of this is about community. We're here to support community businesses owned by people that live in the community, who employ our neighbors and our friends and our family members from the community. And I think that's what we're all here to support.
And then without further ado, the cash mob went down to Visible Voice Books. That's a local independent bookstore. And waltzed right in, waving little green portraits of Andrew Jackson.
$23.68.
And within minutes, the checkout counter was manned by four people, catering to a Wednesday night crowd. They said it was about four times bigger than normal.
You can stick a bookmark in there for them.
So, Brian, let's talk about why this place was specifically targeted by the cash mob. Obviously, it's local, but there must be more than one local store there. So how did they pick this one?
The cash mobbers I talked to said that they target small independent businesses that give back to the community somehow. And the Visible Voice holds readings, socials. It's regarded as a pretty valuable community resource there in the Tremont area. And it's nothing they say is against the big box stores, but they just feel like the smaller independent businesses are the backbone of Cleveland's economy. Here's owner David Ferrante.
On one level, you got a situation where you got people taking the idea of a cash mob or a mob, which is in this town has some negative connotations attached to it, and they're turning around to a positive thing. But the underlying piece of it is the fact that he's really trying to build exposure for an independent, non-corporate operation, because, you know, the mom and pop stores like this, that really adds to the diversity of the city and the neighborhood.
And I should add too, Tess, that while $20 was the set amount to spend for this cash mob, no one was limited to that, as I learned from cash mobber Cynthia Boncella.
I got two great books. One just called out to me. It's called The American Nerd. And the other one is a book called The Marriage Plot, which is by the author who did The Virgin Suicide.
If I may ask, how much did that come up to?
Just about 44. Which, you know, I'm okay with.
And I'm sure Visible Voice is okay with.
I'd assume they would be, too.
So, Brian, this is really all about giving people a chance to use their money in a constructive way, in a way that perhaps could help out some local businesses in this tough economic era. And I assume that the hope is that this kind of thing could spread like the Occupy Wall Street movement?
I think you're right, Tess. The organizers here in Cleveland say they plan to have another one in early December. And they also add that people in San Diego, Houston, Portland, Oregon, Cincinnati, and even London over in the UK have contacted them asking how they can set up cash mobs in their very own cities. I think people are drawn to an activity that's really helping small businesses recover from the recession. One economic think tank here in Ohio released a report that projected that holiday retail sales are going to go up a modest 3% compared to last year. But still, you know, during the holiday season, every little bit helps. So I think, you know, just kind of tying into the whole Occupy Wall Street movement and being able to go non-corporate and support local businesses, per se, this is probably just the beginning, I think.
All right. Brian Bull joining us from station WCPN in Cleveland. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tess.
Buy local isn't the only consumer rallying cry you'll hear these days. Buy used is another one. And not just used, but refurbished. Stuff that has been returned to the manufacturer for some reason, refurbed, and sold at a discount. Our own Nancy Marshall Genzer became an expert after shopping for a cell phone.
Now, I do have a bit of history with refurbs. My husband, Jan Genzer, started buying refurbs long before we were married. He sat down at our kitchen table with me recently to reminisce.
Honey, do you remember your first refurb?
I think everyone remembers their first refurb.
His was a piece of broadcast equipment for a new radio show he was starting. That was back in 93. There have been many more refurbs in his life since then.
I couldn't begin to quantify the number of refurbs that I've acquired over the years. My favorite refurb, that washer and dryer, those are really good.
Good and durable. He got them as refurbs more than 10 years ago, and they're still going strong. We also have a refurb lawnmower. My husband loves refurbished auto parts. His laptop is a refurb, and he just got a refurbished iPod Touch. He's trying to turn me into a refurb fan and has already started indoctrinating our 2-year-old twin boys.
Refurb.
Yes, now say refurb.
Refurb.
Who can say refurb?
So as I shop for a new cell phone, I have a long family tradition to uphold. I have my heart set on an iPhone. Of course, my husband wants me to get a refurb. That would save money. Refurbished products are up to 70% cheaper than new ones. I like that. But they usually have been returned to the manufacturer for some reason. I don't like that. So I asked Jack Gillis for some advice. He's with the Consumer Federation of America.
About 1 in 5 products that we buy is returned. And the vast majority of those returns are not for reasons of defect. They are simply because we didn't like the item, we decided that we didn't need the item.
Gillis says some things classified as refurbs aren't actually factory returns. They might have been floor models, overstock, or open box, with the box slid open but the product inside never touched. But Gillis says if a refurb was returned after someone bought it, you may have a short warranty.
That warranty may be beginning when the original person purchased the product. So therefore, you won't get as much time on the warranty. It might be worth it to take that gamble, but beware. If it doesn't have a good warranty, there's a potential problem for you down the road.
Gillis says you're more likely to have problems with something that has lots of moving parts, like a washing machine or a lawnmower. There are fewer things that can go wrong with electronics. Gillis says beware of refurbs sold as is, meaning they have no warranty and can't be returned. That got me to thinking, are there a lot of problems with refurbs?
The complaints that we've been getting on refurbished products has been growing. It peaked in 2009. We got over 3,000 complaints that year about refurbished products.
That's Catherine Hutt, chief spokeswoman for the Better Business Bureau. Guess what refurbished products got the most complaints?
We get the most complaints about refurbished cell phones.
Oh, great. But Hutt also says that's not surprising.
I think that's not reflective of the cell phone refurbishers as much as it's reflective of how often we replace our cell phones. We replace our cell phones more often than we replace our TVs.
So there are a lot more refurbished cell phones floating around to complain about. And Hutt says complaints about all refurbs have flattened out after that peak in 2009. That's good news. Still, I'm wavering, trying to decide between refurb and new. There's absolutely no doubt in my husband's mind.
I've been very fortunate in my experience with refurbs, but I think they're less likely to give you problems than buying that new stuff.
So, honey, would you be horrified if I bought a new iPhone?
If that's what you want, I'll still love you. But I think you should try really hard to find a refurb iPhone.
So I started looking for a refurbed iPhone. But you know what? They're really hard to find. I guess everyone's figured out that refurbs are a good deal. So I had to buy a new iPhone. My husband is still speaking to me. My kids are delighted with any new gadget.
No.
But I do have to keep my phone away from them. It does have a full warranty. But unfortunately, it doesn't cover natural disasters like a toddler temper tantrum. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
If you're in Philadelphia this weekend, you might want to look before crossing the street, not for cars, but for runners in that city's big marathon. For many of them, including commentator Jen Miller, training for this race came with a surprisingly high price tag, but it's a price she's willing to pay.
Running? It sounds like a cheap sport. Just throw on some sneakers, an old beat-up t-shirt, shorts, and go. But not in 2011, not in a country in the middle of a major running boom. Let's look at the cost of training for the Philadelphia Marathon, which I will run this Sunday. $134 to register for the race. $420 for sneakers. That's the cost of two pairs since I wore through one already. $32 for six pairs of sweat-wicking socks. Then another $120 for three pairs of running tights and $50 for two new running tops. Then there's the unrecorded cost. Doing twice as much laundry per week, for example. Driving to and from Fairmount Park in Philadelphia to do my weekly long runs. I've lost count of how much Gatorade I've consumed, and I feel like I'm eating three times as much food because I am hungry all the time. I have had some luck, though. 2 years ago, I asked my then-boyfriend to get me something that sparkled for my birthday. Instead, he bought me a Garmin GPS running watch. But that ended up working out because I got this $350 device that tracks my time, pace, and distance in real time for free. Yes, running is expensive, but here's the thing. I love every second. Running is the only time when I'm not tethered to the rest of the world. Some of my runs are 20 miles long. For 3 hours, no one can call or text. No one can bother me. I'm in better physical condition than I've ever been in my life, and I was a three-sport athlete in high school. Sure, I could put the running money into my emergency savings or use it to bulk up my retirement account, but I want to live long enough to get to retirement age. Running keeps me fit and sane. It's a different kind of investment. Look, I'm never going to be a professional runner, and I've only finished first place in one race, my little town's 5K. But I will keep running, and I will keep paying for that privilege.
Jen Miller writes for Runner's World and the New York Times. You can find her on Twitter at Jersey Shore Jen. And while you're at it, follow me at Radio Tess. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
You know, I wanted to briefly touch on a column that you wrote recently. You know, I think a lot of people hope and assume that the Credit Card Act that was passed a couple of years ago finally offered them some real protection. But what you wrote about shows that even laws protecting you from the fine print don't protect you.
You know, Tess, it's like whack-a-mole. Every time we find some shenanigan involving the banks, it's like another thing comes up. And in this case, it's a credit protection plan. Every major bank offers something like this.
And it's kind of like insurance if you can't pay.
Exactly. It's like insurance. You're going to pay a little bit every month. And if you need to use this insurance, what it says is effectively, if you lose your job, you're not going to have to make any payments on your credit card for maybe up to 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a valid product, and the banks are fine to offer it. The trick is you just want to disclose all the terms and conditions in advance so that customers can make informed decisions about it, and Citibank gets a major booby prize for not doing that.
So describe for us what happened to this gentleman who signed up for this card and ended up having to use this insurance and thought he did everything right.
The guy's a freelance TV producer here in L.A. He'd been a year without work, but he didn't want to use the credit protection. He didn't want to do anything that could affect his credit score. So he held on for as long as he could, but then his mom got sick. He had to start paying hospital bills. And so he finally contacts Citi and says, I need to use it, so I'm going to kick it in now. Well, they sent him a letter saying, no, you're not. And the reason you're not is because you didn't notify us 180 days of the job loss event. And this guy I'm writing about says, I never knew anything about that. Where did that six-month rule come from?
Presumably in the fine print?
Not even there, Tess. And that's what's so egregious about that. When you look at the website for Citi's credit protection plan, you can scour it with a fine-tooth comb. You will not find that particular rule. And in fact, they've got a program summary that they link to everywhere. I mean, throughout the website, no matter where you are in the process, there are multiple links to get at this program summary, which is a 1,400-word document, which in theory contains all the pertinent information you need to know.
You read all 1,400 words?
Every last comma. And I'm telling you, it's not in there. And when I contacted Citi and said, where is that six-month rule being noted? And they said, well, it's in the frequently asked questions, which is a funny place to put it, first
yes.
of all. But then I went there. The only place this comes up is under the question, how do I activate my credit protection? And when you click on that, it gives you a phone number and it says, call this number within 180 days of losing your job. It doesn't say what happens if you don't call within 180 days. It doesn't say that you will lose your benefit if you don't make that effort. There's nothing spelled out.
So how did Citi react when you pointed this out to them?
Tess, I wish I could say that they fell on their sword immediately and said, oh, you're right, we forgot to disclose it, we're going to do it. No, they said that we feel that we are adequately disclosing this because after you sign up, you will get a welcome kit that has even more voluminous terms and conditions, and it's in there. In other words, you will not be told of this rule explicitly until you buy the product. And when I said to them, so you feel like this is good disclosure? They said, well, we feel that we've disclosed it in enough places, which they have not. That's just wrong.
Oh, it makes me sad. So let's go to our callers, shall we?
Nice segue.
They cheer me up.
Oh, okay.
All right. Randall is with us from Leoma, Tennessee. Hi, Randall.
Hi. How are you, Tess?
Very well. Did I pronounce the name of your city correctly?
That is correct. Leoma.
Well, what are you doing today?
I am actually going to bake today. My church is having their annual craft and bake sale tomorrow, one of our many fundraisers for the St. Francis Project. We're giving away $1 million.
Whoa. Wait a minute. $1 million?
$1 million, $100,000 a year for 10 years.
Where'd you get that kind of money?
We raise it. We give it. It's everyone coming together. The craft and bake sale, while it sounds kind of small, is actually kind of large, but that's just one of our many fundraisers.
Yeah, well, sounds fantastic. Where does the money go?
It goes to local nonprofits and other organizations that help the needy in our community that have seen funding cuts, and we just try to fill those gaps.
I got to ask, what are you baking?
I'm making my grandmother's oatmeal cookies, which she called boiled cookies. I'm making 8 dozen of those and a carrot cake and an apple caramel cake.
Well, you know, I'm, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that anytime the word cookie comes up, that I have to demand that you actually send us some.
Well, you know what? I'll hang on the line, and I don't know if I have packaging that would make the trip all the way to L.A., but I can send you some.
Okay, so you send Tess some cookies, you send me $100,000 a year for the next 10 years, and we're
yeah.
good. We're good.
You go.
Well, what can we help you out with today?
I'm one of those people that, well, not militant in my actions, I'm leaving Bank of America. And several years ago when I signed up with Bank of America, I started out a small stock portfolio, and I managed everything there. However, I'm moving to my local credit union, and I wanted to try to do something with my stock. I don't have a lot, but I'm going to be charged $100 to close my account.
Oh, yeah. You know, David, we have been hearing this, particularly since Bank Transfer Day, about all the people who were charged money to leave the bank.
A kick in the pants as you're heading out the door.
Yep.
Just, you gotta like it.
Well, no, you don't have to like
no,
it.
No, that's true, you don't.
That's me being facetious there, Randall.
Well, I know, but, it's kind of just been a bee in my bonnet.
Randall, I'm guessing that, of course, your new credit union doesn't offer any sort of brokerage service, right?
No, what I'd like to know, is there a online brokerage firm that is relatively inexpensive that I can just go on, do what little trading I need to do, and then how do I get out of this $100 fee?
Well, first of all, you're not going to get out of the $100 fee. They're going to dig their heels in, and why shouldn't they? Because you're out the door.
Right.
When it comes to a discount broker, which is what you're looking for now, I can't offer any recommendations on that, but I can tell you there are a number of them out there.
Many.
you know, some of the big name places, you know, Schwab or
Vanguard.
I've seen that.
Here's what I want to advise you to look for, and that is these businesses, especially these days, are trying to win your business. And in so doing, what they're offering are some pretty neat welcome to our company deals where they're going to give you a whole bunch of trades either for free or for an incredibly low price. And that's the way they're trying to sweeten the deal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, very good. Well, thank you. That helps me out, and I'll do some more research on this.
Terrific. Thanks so much for the call, Randall, and good luck with the bake sale.
Oh, thank you, Ted.
We'll be looking for those cookies.
And the money.
All right.
And the money for David.
Yes.
All right. Thanks Bye-bye. A lot. All right. Let's next go to Penny, and she is in Evanston, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi, Tess. Hi, David.
So how is everything for you?
Well, fine.
Oh, and well, you know, I should have looked at this before I asked that question. My producer's notes here say that you were recently laid off. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, in June.
Wow. What were you doing?
I do fundraising, and I was working at the University of Illinois in Chicago for a program called Ceasefire.
Ceasefire? What is that?
It stops the gang violence. It's actually a public health model. And it was founded by an epidemiologist who came to the conclusion that violence is like a disease, that people catch it from each other. The organization developed a way of dealing with it called interrupters. So they train people to go into the violent situations and kind of de-escalate it. And they just recently did a documentary called The Interrupters.
Oh, you know what? And that must be, I have another note here from Steven, my producer, saying that we actually have a clip of that. So shall we take a listen to that?
Sure.
The violence interrupters have one goal in mind, stop killings. They're not trying to dismantle gangs. What they're trying to do is save a life. All we want to know is what happened in this situation, how can we resolve it, and how can people live in peace and coexist?
Wow, so that's fascinating.
It really is.
Taking a health epidemic model and applying that to gang violence.
But not just that, sending people in to intervene.
Yeah,
that's not necessarily a very safe thing to be doing.
You're right.
So, unfortunately, you were laid off?
Yes. You know, the funding here in Illinois has been pretty tight.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Well, what have you been doing since then?
Well, the main thing I've been doing is looking for another job. So if you hear of any.
Yeah, we'll let you know. Absolutely. Well, what can we help you out with today?
Well, I have a question. Because my situation, I've kind of been looking at the whole picture. And basically, I'm 62 years old, and I was making about $75,000 a year. Right now, I'm receiving unemployment. I own a condo, and I've been trying to sell it because I feel like if I could scale down a little bit and have fewer expenses, that would be helpful.
Right.
My original plan was I wanted to work until I was 70 and keep saving. That way, when I retired and took Social Security, it would be about $2,700 a month.
So are you toying with tapping into your Social Security early?
I'm kind of thinking about it. If I do it now, it's going to be $1,700.
Big difference.
It makes a big difference, especially down the road.
So, David, I think what we're looking at here is the question of whether to go ahead and tap that Social Security amount. Can you kind of express for us how tight things are right now for you?
Financially?
Yeah.
I am probably using like $1,000 to $1,500 a month out of savings.
Oh, right. Boy.
I'll tell you, Penny, you got a few moving parts here, but your situation is in no way unique. There are so many other people who are facing exactly the same kind of choices you are right now, and I wish there weren't. First of all, you're already ahead of the game. You're looking at liquidating your big asset, the condo. You know, tough decision, but it sounds like you've already made it. I agree with Tess. The big decision here is, do you go for the Social Security money now or try to put it off? And I can't say this emphatically enough. Put it off. You just find some way to try to make it down the road, because that difference of $1,000 a month in your sunset years is going to be crucial.
Yeah.
And it's just going to be huge, especially as your medical costs start rising. My advice, you're already out there looking for work. Keep searching for that full-time job. Try and find some kind of part-time gig in the interim. Maybe one's not going to have any benefits. You're not going to be able to get health care or anything from it, but you're going to get enough of a paycheck. And then when you finally do start drawing on Social Security when you're 70 and you're looking at that $2,700 a month, you're going to say, boy, I'm glad that's there.
Well, I'm glad you said that, David, because that's exactly what I've been thinking. And it's comforting to know that a professional thinks that, too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's something that we do try to talk about on the program, is that the longer you can hold that off, the more grateful you are going to be in the end.
Right.
And it's your money. You know, I can't say this emphatically enough. You have been paying into this system your entire working life. Don't cheat yourself.
Right.
So does that help you out, Penny?
It really does. It makes me feel much more confident.
All right. Good luck with the job hunt.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, and finally, we have Melissa in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And you?
I'm doing great.
And what do you do there in Raleigh?
I work for one of the universities here.
Doesn't everybody?
Practically. Yes, actually, they do.
Well, what can we help you out with today?
Well, I have a question, but I first want to start with the positive.
Okay.
My husband and I both have been doing a really great job of putting some money away in our retirement.
Okay.
And so we feel really confident about the money that we're putting away for retirement, but a few years ago, we had some money in our savings account, but we have since started a family,
mm-hmm.
and we've seen our savings account dwindle and dwindle. And
funny how that happens when children come along.
It's the darndest thing. It's like a hole in your pocket.
Exactly. And now our savings and our money market accounts have very little left. So whenever kind of a major expense comes along, we have to put it on our credit card, and we've just recently turned around and seen that we're both carrying several thousand dollars of debt.
Can you talk to me about what you mean by several thousand?
Let's see. I think we both have over five.
Okay. A little more than several, but okay.
Yeah. More okay. than we want.
So are you looking for other ways to try to boost your savings? Are you looking at trying to bring more income into the house?
Well, that's my question, is should we be looking at maybe reducing the amount that we're putting into our retirement accounts right now? Or is that just a horrible idea and you should never consider that?
I don't think that there's anything that you should ever not consider. Of course, as you know, as a regular listener to the program, we try to encourage everybody to leave that retirement money alone. But, you know, you also don't want to have credit card debt
exactly.
hanging around your neck.
I'll say this. It sounds like Melissa and her husband are pretty on top of
mm-hmm.
their finances. The fact that they're talking about them and they're looking at the entire landscape, I mean, that's putting you ahead of the game, too. Oh, here I am accentuating the positive as well, Melissa. I've got kind of a radical idea for you guys. Since you are on top of your finances, here's my suggestion to you. Get rid of the plastic. Pay everything out of cash as you go. And if you can't afford things, don't pay for it. And you'll see not only will your savings be protected, but you'll be even more prudent in how you're going to be managing your money because you obviously won't be carrying any debt.
Right.
So what do we think about her idea that they, you know, maybe by a percentage point or two drop the amount that's going into the retirement contribution?
See, I'm with you, Tess. I think you want to protect your retirement savings
yep.
as long and as much as you can, because once you start chipping away, it's the slippery slope. You're going to say, well, I reduced it here and I'm going to reduce it again
mm-hmm.
because we've got this hospital bill now. And, you know, we all understand that. And before you know it, you're just not setting aside enough. And the trick to retirement isn't that you're going to be putting $1 million aside and say, okay, now I'm covered. But no, it's a little bit here, a little bit here,
right.
a little bit here, until one day you got a big chunk of change and you're saying, whew, I'm glad I was smart about that all that time.
Okay.
Does that help you out?
I think so. I do. That was a lot of my intuition there that you kind of reiterated, but it's always good to hear it from a professional.
Yeah, well, I mean, like we said, again, you know, there are no absolutes. You know, as David said, life comes along and throws you all kinds of stuff, and, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But
right.
unless and until you get to that point where it's an absolute have to, we want you to save as much as you possibly can.
But do talk to your husband about throttling back on the plastic. See what
yep.
happens when you do it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And to be perfectly honest, right now, it seems like we're only using them in an emergency situation and or when Christmas rolls around.
Yeah, but, you know, Christmas doesn't have to be a big spending spree.
We were talking to a guy earlier who's baking cookies today.
Yep. Oh, you know? Wow. Yeah.
I love getting cookies for Christmas.
Absolutely.
That's a good idea. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
Thanks so much for the call and good luck.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. David, it's been great to see you. And as we approach next Thursday, may I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go stand by the mailbox and hope the cookies arrive.
Me too. And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. So every time we talk about credit cards on this program, we get letters from two listener camps. One argues no one should ever use credit cards. No way, no how, evil incarnate. The other says, hey, stop vilifying credit cards. Cards don't get people into debt. People do. Well, we're going to revisit the issue today with our friend Carmen Wong Ulrich, author of The Real Cost of Living. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tess. Thanks for having me.
So given all the news lately, do you think it's a wise decision to switch over from credit to debit? I mean, what are the real benefits of using debit over credit?
I'm a fan of the other way around, of actually using credit over debit.
Ah.
I just don't think credit cards are evil in and of themselves. And actually, the majority of Americans, 80% of Americans who use credit cards, have no trouble with credit cards and don't carry a balance.
Wait a minute. I'm going to stop you there. 80% of Americans don't carry a balance.
Exactly. But the ones who do carry a balance carry an incredibly high balance.
Huh.
So that really skews the numbers.
But it sounds to me like the real kicker there is that you have to be actively paying attention and actively managing your credit card. I mean, at least, you know, at least with a debit card, there aren't as many fees. And in fact, the banks have started backing off that recently. But boy, you can rack up interest charges. You can rack up all kinds of fees with credit cards. So you really have to pay attention.
Yes. I always say to folks, you know, when it comes to this question, it's know yourself. Are you someone who's going to carry a balance? Are you able to spend within them? If not, then don't use credit cards. I recommend to build credit, then just rotate a couple of cards and use them only for one specific thing. For example, use a gas card just for gas. But make sure that you have these limits on yourself if you know you're not going to be able to handle it.
All right, let's get to my main question, which is one that listeners write in quite often about, which is how many credit cards is kind of a good rule of thumb? Is it a good idea to have multiple cards?
There is no magic number, but I always recommend folks at least have two or three credit cards. A lot of your credit report and credit score is based on length of credit history, but also how much credit you have available to you versus how much you're actually using. So let's say you only have one card and it has a limit of $10,000. You have $3,000 in expenses a month. You pay it off in full, but that card looks like that it's almost 30% utilized. So that's dangerous because then makes your credit score go down.
But then again, you just have to be careful that you're not staring at that thing in your wallet and going, well, maybe I could just put a little something on
Tess,
there.
Tess, you're talking about yourself here, aren't you?
No.
This is the thing. You have to look at credit cards as financial tools for emergency and for use to build your credit, for the perks that can come with it. But the second you start carrying the balance, they turn into a bad thing.
Yep.
With this economy, with this job market, it's not a bad thing to have as much credit at your disposal as long as you don't use it.
Right.
Should you find yourself out of work for an extended period of time, or should you find yourself needing to lean on it? Credit cards got distorted. They never should have been thought of as a tool to basically get great shoes, bags, you know, dining out, whatever it is.
Right.
Never should have been thought of as that.
Okay, well, you just mentioned perks, but isn't it true that most cards that have these reward programs also charge some sort of annual fee for that? I mean, how do you balance that fee against the potential rewards?
Well, it depends on how much you use the card.
Hmm.
Myself, for example, my annual fee is $45. Now, they keep on sending me notices to upgrade to another card that has more perks but costs 10 times that a year. I have no use for that. You really have to know yourself and your credit behavior to know if $75 or $150 or $450, when does it make sense to make that annual fee and that annual payment? When you talk about when you swipe, that vendor, they were getting charged quite a bit on debit cards, but they also get charged more when you swipe a reward card. So it's just something to keep in mind if you know a small business owner and you're close with them. Maybe you want to spare them that 12% fee or whatever it is they get to pay for the rewards that you get. It's a very, you know, interesting system.
All right. Carmen, thanks. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Tess.
And if you want even more arguments for and against both debit and credit, we've got them on our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. We've all been here, driving around the block for the 10th time, waiting for a spot to open up.
I would sit there and I'd be like, all right, parking space, I know you're out there. Let's do it. We can do this.
Looking for parking is pretty awful for everybody, but San Francisco is trying to change that with a new program called SF Park. The idea is for meter and garage rates to be based on demand. Popular blocks are going to cost more. Less crowded ones will be cheaper. The question is whether the plan will actually change consumer parking behavior. Casey Miner of station KALW has our story.
When Laura Parr and her husband lived in San Francisco's Knob Hill neighborhood, there was one ritual that defined their weekends. He'd drop her off
with all of our bags of groceries and stuff, and you know, we would double park and take all the stuff into the front of our building, and then he would take off to find parking.
This was not an easy task.
And I would take all of our stuff upstairs, take a couple of trips, you know, I would unpack all of our groceries. I'd fix dinner, I'd eat dinner, I'd start getting ready for bed, and Ian would still be driving around looking for parking.
Once, she says, he drove around for an hour and a half.
I think one time he cried. He was so upset, so stressed.
In crowded San Francisco, this is not an uncommon story. But now, as with so many things, there's an app for that.
The goal is so that most of the time, someone's experience is that they can find a space within a block or two of their destination really quickly.
Meet Jay Primus. He's the manager of SF Park, the city's new effort to impose some reason on a highly emotional experience. Load up the SF Park smartphone app, and you'll see neighborhood maps colored red and blue. Blue blocks have plenty of parking. Red ones, not so much. Blue blocks are also cheaper, sometimes by as much as 50 cents or a dollar. But they're also usually further away from places you might want to go. The city hopes the discount will make walking the extra block or two worthwhile.
So it's a little bit like the Goldilocks principle. And in this case, that prices aren't too high or too low, that it's just about right for the demand that we see.
The info comes from data transmitted constantly by thousands of sensors embedded in the pavement around the city.
To actually see what's happening on the streets was kind of shocking in that there weren't necessarily the clear patterns you would expect.
On a recent weekday, Primus and I took a walk around Civic Center to look at where people were parked and where they weren't.
Right now we're on Grove Street on the south side of City Hall, looking at the parking spaces, seeing the app is showing all red, and we're seeing only one parking space available out of about 20.
Some things about the data are obvious, like you probably can't find parking in the financial district during work hours. But the maps reveal a lot of little secrets, too. Like, if you're looking to park downtown, you can almost always find a space right by City Hall.
And letting people know those secret spots, or that what were secret spots, of where parking really is available.
Looking at the data, it becomes clear pretty quickly that San Francisco's parking problem isn't availability. It's distribution. People just don't always know where the empty spaces are.
It amounted to about a million miles of vehicle travel a year hunting for cheap curb parking.
Donald Shoup is a professor of urban planning at UCLA. He did a study a while back about how much driving people did just trying to find a parking space.
That's 36 trips around the Earth or 4 trips to the moon in a little 15-block area, and I think it's happening all over the world.
Shoup did his study in Los Angeles and consulted with San Francisco on SF Park. He says a lot of what drives our behavior is habit and ignorance. That's why we need rewards.
People have to know that it's cheaper, you know, 3 blocks away, and that they can find a space 3 blocks away.
Even with information and price incentives, changing people's behavior isn't easy, especially when that behavior doesn't make sense. The weirdest thing about J. Primus's parking maps are the places where all logic seems to go out the window. At an intersection near City Hall, one side of the street is almost always packed. On the maps, totally red. But cross to the other side, and it's pretty much always empty. On the maps, totally blue. Just to be clear, these blocks are right next to each other. So what's going on?
One block down on Hayes is where the stores begin, and probably a lot more people want to start parking. So people probably want to get a little closer to their destination. This is a peak period tow-away zone.
Primus listed a lot of reasons why people might not park on an empty block. And they were little things, like maybe the block becomes a no-parking zone for a few hours in the evening. Or the street goes from a two-way to a one-way, so it's sort of inconvenient to get to. So will cheaper rates be enough to move people?
We're not trying to change the behavior of a lot of people. So that on that one block that's totally full, we just need two of those people to go somewhere else.
If the program works, Primus thinks it will make life better for everyone, especially people who get really worked up about parking, like Laura Parr. She and her husband now live in another neighborhood where they have parking. But she says she's still recovering from her years of circling the block.
It sounds crazy, but you know, you get to this point and it's just this breaking point.
And at that point, paying a little extra for sanity might not be so bad. In San Francisco, I'm Casey Miner for Marketplace Money.
Round one goes to the consumers. Most of the big banks decided within the last couple of weeks to scrap their plans for a monthly debit card fee. But the costs really just shifted elsewhere. Bank of America is charging $5 for a replacement if you lose your debit card. U.S. Bancorp is charging 50 cents to deposit checks with your cell phone. There are plenty of alternatives, of course, including credit unions. And here's another one. It's called Simple. Not exactly a bank, but kind of works like one, without all the fees, the hassle, the headaches. Joshua Reich is the CEO. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
So first things first, what is Simple? Are you a bank? Are you not a bank?
So Simple is designed to replace your bank. You know, when you are a customer of a bank today, you're likely to open up a checking account, a savings account. The more accounts that a customer has at a bank, the more likely that bank is to make money. Banks make most of their money when customers make mistakes, namely from fees. We give customers one card and one account. And one thing that we do that's quite different is we don't make any profits from the fees that we charge. And for the most part, we remove most of the fees that consumers would come across on their day-to-day banking.
So there is only one card, then how do you know if you're using it as debit or credit?
So the card itself is a debit card. And what that means is whenever you swipe it, it goes over the debit network, which is actually the cheapest network for most merchants to process.
Right.
It arrives at our systems in real time. And we then look at that transaction and say, okay, if you have CDs open through us, should we break a CD to fund this transaction?
You're making that decision?
We're making that decision, but we're doing it with your help. Obviously, you know, the interest rate on the credit line is always going to be higher than the interest rate you're going to be earning on savings. That's
right.
Just how these accounts work. Let's say then, for example, that you had a credit line with us and a three-month CD with us. We then have to make the choice. Do we want to break that CD or do we want to go to credit? We know how often you get paid. We know what you typically spend each day. We can do that math for you. If you had a pencil and paper at the time of purchase, you know, you could do that math too. But it's a lot easier for a computer to do that, knowing that we're doing it with your interest in mind.
I have to say, though, as you're saying all that, I'm wondering to myself if I want you to know all that about me.
Well, your bank already does know all that, and the reality is they're not using that information to help you. You know, whenever you swipe your card at a bank today, it's more likely that they're going to use that information to market products to you. Or some banks are just selling that information, obviously, to other marketers. So you'll get around Christmas time, you'll get ads for cars you don't want.
Right.
We don't do that. We think that there's this wealth of information that the banks know about you that should be used for your benefit. The first obvious place to do that is around your finances.
Are these banks then basically outsourcing their customer service to you?
In one way, you can think of it like that. We tend to work with small banks and mid-sized regional banks. And the banks that we work with tend to not have great customer-facing technology. The largest bank we work with is a bank out of Delaware called the Bancorp Bank. You know, it doesn't really have a large consumer presence. They specialize in operating banking back-end infrastructure to other companies. So it's hard for consumers to work with them.
Well, if you're not charging me any fees, how are you staying in business? How are you making money?
We actually get paid by the banks. The banks typically have to maintain one of two ways to acquire customers. One is to have an extensive and expensive branch network. The other way that banks acquire customers is by offering those teaser rates on CDs and savings accounts. By working with us, we provide a better service and we acquire customers that the banks couldn't otherwise get. And so they pay us for that service.
All right. Joshua Reich is the CEO of Simple, and we've been talking about their new website for your banking needs. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Margate, Florida, and the home of Brian McGuinn, who will get along great with our pig because he knows personally what it's like to wade in slop. Here's how the story begins.
I threw out my wife's ring in the trash, and it was an adventure from that point on.
Not just any ring, but Anna McGuinn's 1.5-carat diamond and platinum engagement ring.
After coming to the realization that not only had he thrown it in our kitchen trash, but he had taken our trash to our local community dumpster the night before, I was absolutely horrified.
Did we mention that Brian is a financial planner? So not only was this an emotional loss, but needless to say, a monetary one.
Well, you know, you do think numbers instantly, but it kind of all just faded away the minute I looked at my wife and just saw, you know, the expression on her face.
So what did Brian do? Why, he went to the dump, of course. Waded through a 9-ton, 10-foot-high pile of stink and found her ring.
Actually, just went right to her office with the ring. I just so wanted to get that back on her finger, I didn't even wash it off.
He flipped it on, sludge covered and all.
And oh, the life lessons to be imparted here.
I learned that I'm never going to touch my wife's jewelry again. That's the easy part. But I also learned that, you know, if you want something, you can get it. You're just going to have to push your butt for it.
Me, I've learned never to take the ring off again. And this has been reconfirmed. What an amazing, wonderful husband I have. So I'm very blessed.
And so we award a piggy to the McGuinns. Perhaps he can help save up for the dry cleaning bill. Meantime, we have advised him not to go wading in the Everglades. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, you know that airfares are manipulated by computer algorithms, but you may not know these things are too.
Hotels, rental cars, freight.
Ticket sales for concerts and for baseball games.
Automotive, retail, consumer packaged goods, cruise lines.
We'll explain dynamic pricing while you digest your turkey. Marketplace Money is produced by Devin Robbins with Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.